Hey folks, well let's make a start and hopefully sort of put this up as a podcast so people who aren't actually here will be able to catch up. We have reached the stage where we're in the eighth week of the module. And it's that mass media concern that really was huge for the last five decades of the 20th century and arguably still has a place to play. And a part to play when you look at the amount of column inches that are given week in, week out to that beast that you call television. Channels, streaming, satellites, whichever way you consume it, whether you're looking at tablets, whether you're looking at traditional TVs, it's still very much a potent mass medium. And what I want to actually talk about today and raise a few issues about is a little bit of history. How it developed, how it grew to the phenomenon that we've got today, and also some of the kind of challenges that it's been faced with in terms particularly of what we would refer to as public service broadcasting, so PSB, and also what we would refer to as commercial broadcasting. And there are, as you might expect, and I kind of alluded to this when I was talking about radio, some similarities between the two. We look at some of the theories behind mass media, and certainly theories with respect to television, and I've got an exercise for you to take away and actually deal with your friends and families, assuming they're not self-isolating, or indeed various other folk, about television watching habits and other things as well, which we'll either talk about on Thursday or probably again resume next Monday. Okay? So, I've titled this little piece, as you can see there, Framing Television. That's primarily because I want to contextualise it, and what we do academically is we kind of set up a particular thesis and then hopefully sort of support it, or not, as the case may be. Michael Tracy, for that's the Christian name of that particular academic, Michael Tracy, in 1998, in a text which was all about media, etc., came up with that fairly self-evident statement. And although it's fairly self-evident, it's worth just taking a few moments to kind of look at it and get your heads around it, etc. Because clearly, it's the difference between the BBC and CBS, or ITV, or Sky, or any of the sort of systems that are actually there, because... Are you all right there?
Yeah, I was looking for a plug for Charlie, but I think they're all going to be on the other side.
Yes, I've got them all here. Do you just want to charge your computer or your phone device?
No, just my laptop. It's like 2% or something.
Will you be able to cope without the laptop? This could be a major routine.
Yeah, I will use it. I want to find the plug. I'll go plug it.
Okay, whilst James sorts his cells through, take a moment, as I say, to look at the sort of system that you've got there. In a commercial system, they make programs to acquire money. Not a million miles away from the line that I was using a few weeks ago when I was saying that the business of commercial radio is to deliver audiences to advertisers. Okay? How was sort of working with that? Are you settled comfortably now?
I'm all good. I'm ready.
Good. Okay. So how did television develop? Well... The first Prime Minister in Britain to be provided with a television set was Ramsay MacDonald. Kerry, do you know when Ramsay MacDonald was the Prime Minister of Britain?
Ooh. I didn't know he was Prime Minister.
Yeah, he was. 1930. Okay, 1930. So 1930 was when Ramsay MacDonald effectively had his television set provided for him. And, frankly, he wasn't quite sure what the heck it was. That he knew it was a device for receiving images and pictures transmitted over a distance. You know, the very name itself, television, telos from the Greek, meaning distance, and vision, obviously, to see. So seeing over a distance. But it's fair to say that the early forms of television were very similar to what we now refer to as Skype. Okay? In other words, it wasn't seen as a medium to transmit entertainment, but it was a communications medium. A bit like the telephone, except you could see the person you're speaking to. It's a bit like the video phone, or various other sort of aspects that you've got within that. And that kind of line was there in the 1920s. If you look at stories at the time and various thrillers and writings that were sort of dealing with crime and so on. They were focusing on people using the televisual image as a way of communicating with people, etc., rather than it actually being a mass mode of entertainment. But inevitably, given the success of radio, which by the time television was established had already been pretty much a mass medium for about 10 years, television started using a similar kind of mode. So it started using entertainments, variety shows, and a lot of people who were working on radio would cross over and develop within that. And if you were to look at the Radio Times of the 1930s and look at the archive schedules for that particular time, you wouldn't see, you would see something which looked roughly familiar to the kind of genres that we see today, with a couple of notable exceptions. You don't get too many shows telling you how to build your own bomb shelter today. But you do get shows about cookery, you get shows about gardening, you get shows about sport, sporting habits and so on, current affairs, news, entertainment, variety and so on. So there are kind of similarities like that. Just as I said, if you recall last week when we were talking about the motion picture industry, you could see that there are similarities between where we were and where we've come from. Plus ça change, c'est la même chose, as the French would say. The more things change, the more they remain the same. There's the gentleman who was the first Director General of the British Broadcasting Company. He was wounded in the First World War. He was a Scottish gentleman, Calvinist descent, and he saw his role as Director General of the British Broadcasting Company initially in 1922, and then 5 years later the British Broadcasting Corporation, as being very much a mission which he carried out with, as has often been documented, evangelical zeal. He was very keen to promote the notions of information, education, and entertainment. And although I've kind of put a subtext there that he's much nicer than he looks, actually there are a lot of people for whom John Reith was a really nasty person. It was often alleged that he had very solid bullying tactics. If he didn't actually agree with him, then basically you would be banished to parts of the company in the north and so on. He very much operated under a divide and conquer policy. And if you want to find out further details, look at the work of Asa Briggs, who talked extensively about how the BBC developed. But at the same time, the flip side of it is, and there are always flip sides of it, he did actually develop what we now recognise and acknowledge as the BBC in terms of radio and the BBC in terms of broadcasting. Although it's fair to say, Reith wasn't necessarily a fan of television. He saw it as a short-lived term, fad, and so on. And television really started developing after he'd left the BBC in 1937 and then was suspended with a Mickey Mouse cartoon, apparently, at the outbreak of war and hostilities with Germany in September 1939, resuming in 1946 after, obviously, a fairly substantial break. Now, the difference, obviously, between British television and American television is American television didn't have that gap. It kind of continued and developed and evolved very much a kind of commercial-based model as well, which we'll come back to. But Reith, as I said, is rightly regarded as the founding father in terms of managerial terms of what we now refer to as the BBC. Pop quiz question. Can anybody tell me who his current successor actually is? Who is the current Director General of the BBC? And he leaves in a few months' time. So there will be a job opening, if you fancy going for it, Caitlin. Anybody? Tony? Tony Hall. Tony Hall is the current Director General of the BBC. And, just as was the case with respect to radio, the BBC was funded by us, by people effectively who will pay a fee, a set fee, to actually have a television receiver. Just as we used to pay a set fee for a radio receiver, now effectively you pay for the whole essence of a TV licence system. But bear in mind, of course, that your television licence fee didn't commence until 1936, because that's when regular transmission started, and not across the country, pretty much in London and the home counties. You know, we didn't really get a national service for the BBC as far as television was concerned until the post-war period, etc. And so the argument being that as far as the BBC is concerned, if I go back to that early quotes that we actually had about how it's a public service broadcaster. It means it's not necessarily concerned with ratings. Now, the good thing about that is it can make programmes quite literally for anybody. It doesn't have to worry about having large audiences. You know, if they're just single figures watching it, to a certain extent, you could say it's viable. And there is a sort of notion that's saying that if you don't actually have that kind of strength, you can't possibly have diversity, you can't possibly have minority programming, you can't possibly have anything which kind of reflects a cultural overview other than the dominant hierarchy, which happens to be the case. Whether Muffin the Mule was one of those characters, I don't know. Genuine character, look him up on YouTube, you'll see lots of fun about Muffin the Mule and how we love Muffin the Mule. A very popular children's television character. However, it's a fair point to say that in the 1950s, there was an awful lot of concern about the BBC being a monopoly. Why? Well, if you're the only game in town, you don't have any choice as far as the consumer's concerned. And if you've shelled out a significant amount of money for the white goods that are television receivers and so on, you might want to have an alternate view to point of view. And there are always alternative points of view. You might want to actually have something which is more dynamic, more in touch with the youth, more generally representative of the nation, etc. And it was those kind of arguments that led in 1955 to the establishment of the Independent Television Network, and ITV, commercial television, established in Britain 20-odd years before commercial radio was established, but commercial television started in the 1950s. And if we look at the kind of people who are working within commercial television, they were very much impresarios from the theatre, they were business people, they were folk who very much cared about the general world of entertainment, people like Lou Grade, people like Bernard Delfont, and they would set up and establish regional-based companies. In the East Midlands, it would be ATV. We had, obviously, the Tyne Tees Television in the North East. We had Thames Television and so on. So a whole network of independent television operators all feeding into an alternative to the BBC. And, of course, with one important difference, that ITV would use adverts. But that wasn't the only difference. ITV were the first people to actually have on-screen news readers, so you could actually have newscasters in vision. The BBC had often argued that they never wanted to actually identify the name or indeed what the person reading the news looked like in case it kind of took away from the news. You know, to develop the cult of personality was seen as not a good thing. And again, that image that you get when somebody is constantly beamed into your living room, and if you're not going to the cinema, if you, you know, you see, you know, radio, etc., you see the constant line of things, you're getting a huge growth. The kind of figures that BBC and ITV are getting by the time we turn to the 60s are in the 12 to 15 million per show on a regular sort of basis. Because again, you know, it's a mass medium, it's reaching a large number of people simultaneously. There isn't that range of choice. You know, these days, the only kind of figures that are going to reach the sort of 15 million plus are probably sporting events, kind of shared scenario, because there's a much bigger range of choices to actually develop. Now, that might be a good thing, might be a bad thing. Again, if you remember, in terms of radio, I was talking about what happens when the state controls all your media and you just have one choice, you know, Russia Today or Pravda and so on. Is it a bad thing? So, you know, you're nodding, James. Why are you saying?
Because I do a bit of that on my presentation.
I see. Which we will be seeing possibly this week, then, or next week. Yes, very good. Right.
If you're ready.
I'm always ready, James. Always. Okay. And obviously, because ITV is funded by advertising, there is that wonderful argument of saying that actually, in terms of what's bringing in the money to make the programmes, doesn't impact on the audience. Well, of course it does, because clearly the money has to come from somewhere, and companies who actually take out advertising on television because it is expensive usually will pass that advertising budget or collate that advertising budget from increasing the prices of their goods in shops and stores as well. But it's offsetting that. You know, it's the classic marketing line of if they don't know, they won't go. If you don't advertise your particular holiday camps, your toothpaste, your household essentials, etc., or indeed, as say, your wonderful cigarettes on screen, how are people actually going to use them? You know, and things like cigarette advertising, huge business, you know. Lucky Strike, Marlboro Man, Embassy, all standard scenarios, Hamlet Cigars. You know, these are kind of constantly being driven within the advertising industry and so on and so forth. I mean, if you actually look through YouTube at sort of historical ads, you'll thought, how could they possibly ever actually advertise that, given obviously the health issues that are raised today and so on and so, and so forth. In fact, I think of those, certainly the cigarette aspect would actually go. Chocolate, yeah, it's probably been there from that point of view. Rice Krispies, well, I'm not sure with respect to characters from that point of view. Gas commercials, you still get that. Butlins by the Sea, again, you'd sort of get a line from that. First ever commercial on television, I think I mentioned this before a few weeks ago. First ever product that was advertised in commercial television, 1955. Gibbs SR, toothpaste. Okay, the line that sort of came through from that. And of course, as with most things, even old classic favourites like Coronation Street find a way. The soap opera, the ongoing notion of series and serials has developed. And commercial television, because it has to look at ways of economising over programmes, finds a huge market of ready-made programmes in the United States. It's already made; they're already shows made in English, and they're usually made to high quality. So actually buying whole series of The Lone Ranger, Bonanza, other Western, etc., are all part and parcel of that. It's kind of working through the process as well. Plus, of course, you have the other added bonus that because of the McCarthy witch hunts that's taking place in America in the 1950s, an awful lot of people who are outed or effectively accused of un-American activities by the House Un-American Activities Commission, and might have been mildly accused of being a communist and therefore blacklisted in Hollywood, had to find a place to go. So many of them actually came to Britain and started work for the independent television companies. And as they were good script writers, good writers, they'd also develop a quality of product as well. So you get an interesting sort of social history in terms of how that's also developing and so on and so forth. But ultimately, are we actually sort of being a bit too kind to ITV and to BBC? Is there some sort of notion, when we talk about this being the golden age or a license to print money? I mean, clearly, even with one competitor, the BBC is still going to be utilised very much as a representative of the nation, as a way of actually alluding to the notion, by its very name, of what it is to be British, the British Broadcasting Company. It had already been very successful, obviously, with its radio wartime adverts and or programmes as well, from that point of view. So it clearly, obviously, had a trusted mode in terms of that. And the BBC was still sort of viewed as being kind of RTB, but was established as part of the nation as well. ITV was much more of a commercial upstart. There was a huge difference socially as well in terms of school. If you actually went to school and in certain places actually admitted to watching ITV, you were obviously deemed as being working class. You know, there's a kind of interesting class divide that if you were aspirational upper class or aspirational upper middle class, you certainly wouldn't watch ITV. The filthy commercials that are actually on there just would not be seen as appropriate. It took a long time to break away from that. Probably not until probably the 1980s, where that sort of bias was very much there. And there was obviously the tension between, you know, talent who were interspersed, you know, if they go to ITV, they were seen as selling out, you know, they go for the money, and so on and so forth. John Burt, again, a former Director General of the BBC, often regarded as putting together what Private Eye referred to as Burt speak or Dalek speak, very much a precursor to what was regarded as when the accountants took over the BBC, actually came up with that particular viewpoint when he was actually asked to define what he saw as the BBC's essential line from that point of view. And yet, it didn't. Because there were still ways in which the BBC didn't include everybody on society. There were still marginalised people who weren't actually sort of able to actually put their thoughts into action and so on and so forth. You're into this delicate area now of ensuring balance and saying balance and impartiality. And It's the sort of thing that in the recent Brexit debate the BBC was hugely accused of in terms of actually taking a pro-Brexit approach. It's one of the reasons Channel 4 also is kind of faced with the ire of politicians or indeed civil servants who kind of see it as taking an anti-governmental approach. I mean, it's a moot point, and there's lots of studies still to be written about that. But again, how it's being used, is it an instrument of propaganda? Is it a case of information? I mean, is it still true to that original Reithian philosophy of informing, educating, and entertaining? Or in Chasing the Numbers, you know, should the BBC even be considering doing shows like Strictly Come Dancing? Obviously, it's lost the voice, or even Doctor Who, or other sort of audience areas like that, reality TV shows, and so on and so forth. Partly those discussions, and partly the fact that, apart from BBC Two, which launched in the mid-1960s, which still meant you had BBC One, BBC Two, and even that actually created another social hierarchy. Because if you were a middle-class family, you'd probably watch the BBC. If you were an intellectual middle-class family, you'd be watching BBC Two. Because BBC Two had, a bit like BBC Four, the kind of programmes that are a bit more sophisticated, a bit more in-depth, a bit more analytical. Major documentaries, serious documentaries, and so on. And then, of course, there was ITV, which was cheap and cheerful, supposedly. Although, again, there were classic programmes that were being developed, and I mentioned Lou Grade. He was responsible for a number of shows which, in the 60s, culturally proved to be extremely popular and were exported globally under the ITC brand. Roger Moore's vehicle, The Saint, being one of them. The Avengers with John Steed and Emma Peel, again, exporting the notion of Britishness globally. Doctor Who, obviously, has developed its own sort of line and role, has become hugely important in terms of BBC worldwide as a promoter of values, etc. But it's still, you're faced with that whole notion of, okay, well, we've got an audience which is essentially, you're either BBC Two, BBC One, or ITV. Now, compare this in the States, where you still have with cable television channels, as well as the big networks, NBC, CBS, and ABC, you've got an awful lot of affiliates, an awful lot of local stations, awful lot of cable stations. As Bruce Springsteen once said, 57 channels and nothing on. You still had a proliferation of channels, actually. And this is, again, before satellite begins to take hold and promote in terms of that. Channel 4 was supposedly established as a mid-range operator. An operator which would be partly funded by sponsorship, but also would be funded by special interest groups and advertising. So it made clear where its money was coming from, but at the same time it had more latitude in the range of topics it could actually do, the range of sort of projects it could actually do and develop. It's one of the reasons why I always maintain if you want to have a bit more balance in the news, don't just stick with BBC and ITV, look at Channel 4 as well as obviously the online channels and various other things. And what's not to love about BuzzFeed, but that's for another lecture. The final terrestrial channel which developed in Britain was launched in 1997, probably just before many of you were born. And it was launched by the Spice Girls, because there were five Spice Girls, and it's Channel 5. Yay! And it created one or two sort of interesting waves in terms of many people who actually watched Channel 5 had to retune their television sets, given that this was obviously after Rupert Murdoch and Sky Television had really expanded into the market, and satellite television was certainly well established by 1997. But it was interesting, it was using the same kind of motto that ITV used back in the 1950s of cheap and cheerful advertising and so on. These days, Channel 5 seems to be the go-to place for CSI programmes. Every single CSI programme is actually there. And a range of, and obviously there's 5 Live and a variety of other products as well that come through. I just have a quick look at sort of current edition. We see Channel 5. You've got such classic lines as Britain's Naughtiest Nursery, The Dog Rescuers, Me and My Beautiful Face, 7 people living with different faces seek acceptance in what has become an image-obsessed world. 10 years younger in 10 days, recovering alcoholic Paulette has been sober for 6 years, but is in need of a confidence boost. And of course the classic line, billionaire kids, diamond lives, a glimpse into the luxurious lifestyles of children from wealthy families. So, you know, again, you're not necessarily looking for, well, that's going to profoundly impact my understanding of philosophy and life, etc. No, it's looking for, again, lowest common denominator, mass audiences, etc. I mean, I've never understood the phenomenon that actually is true crime drama. the obsession that you've got full CBS true crime drama things, which actually go to the details of how murders were committed, etc. I think it's a very interesting and perhaps, you know, worrying side of things. Although, do we have any true crime sort of lovers here who say, yes, you do, right? What is it, Kerry? Why do you like, is it just you're sort of thinking, that'll help me in terms of advice?
I'm scared that it's going to happen to me, so if I'm confident.
Yeah. Don't be scared, Kerry, all right? Yeah. I'll be afraid, be very afraid, either of those. That'd be fine. Or not, as the case may be. Bearing in mind the programmes I've just mentioned, can you classify Channel 5 as being public service broadcasting? I'm not sure whether you can. I think, you know, asking it rhetorically, Channel 5 are obviously a commercial service. They are the last terrestrial service. They certainly have a number of other channels that they operate under the sort of 5 banner, through the digital network, etc. And they kind of hang on in there. I mean, again, it's a reasonable sort of system, but it's almost as though it was a network and a station that was established after its time had kind of passed in terms of where we currently sit and so on. Okay, moving back slightly, and it's interesting that Fluck and Law, Peter Fluck and John Law, have actually started developing, or they've been commissioned with the new BritBox, to actually produce a whole new series of Spitting Image, which, again, look up on YouTube, highly popular in the 1980s, as indeed the image of Margaret Thatcher in a suit there is part of that whole process. However, the challenge is, have we in a society actually got to a stage where we can actually have that level of satire being beamed into our homes? How are we going to deal with Meghan Markle and Spitting Image? How are we going to deal with Prince Harry? How are we going to deal with, etc., etc.? I mean, I'm sure they might work their way through it in some way, shape, or form, but there are questions being asked about that. Certainly within the 1980s, the reason I put the image of Mrs. Thatcher up there for Spitting Image is not to say it's coming back, because it is, but she was also one of the first major prime ministers who really started honing in on what she believed to be major political bias within the BBC. Politicians had always, both political persuasions, both conservative, Labour, Liberal and others, had kind of maintained that image was everything. And I suppose this all goes back to what arguably was seen as the first election that was decided on image as opposed to substance, and that's the Kennedy-Nixon election of 1960, where those people who actually watched the debate televised between Kennedy and Nixon clearly had Kennedy marked out as the winner because Nixon looked shifty and so on. Those who listened to it on radio maintained actually Nixon had a better argument, but it's another line, and where we are now, of course, is open for a whole range of things than that. But we also came around to something which has certainly been gaining traction, and even more so now, because back in the 80s we had 4 channels, possibly 5, but there was the notion of, why should the BBC actually have a licence fee in the first place? Why should this stealth tax, as it's been referred to, be still in place in an era where many people didn't watch the BBC, and they would actually say, well, look, we only watch ITV, or we only watch Sky. And I mean, these days we will have subscribers to Netflix, Amazon Prime, to all of the sort of channels. You may watch very little BBC, if any. So therefore, why should you pay for it? I'm not sure what's going to happen with respect to that. The BBC has its licence fee renewed roughly every 10 years through the Royal Charter. The next official time up is 2025, 2026. So you'll see a big campaign, certainly in the next couple of years, when, of course, the BBC celebrates its centenary, to start promoting the value for money argument and so on. Whether it'll continue to survive in its current form, I don't know. It's, again, an area from that point of view. Channel 4 was obviously also allowed to sell advertising space in addition to that. And one of the things that Mrs. Thatcher introduced, which certainly created ripples at the time, was she decided to actually auction off ITV franchises to the highest bidder. So Good Morning Britain, effectively, or rather TVAM, was launched on the back of various other sort of areas within that. You've got new sort of companies coming into the area and so on and so forth. Of course, as we head through the 90s to the present day, we have a situation whereby the commerciality is immense, not just with respect to streaming channels, but also with respect to the three essence, the driving force behind all new media over the last few years. Three things, basically. Sex, soccer, and science fiction. Not necessarily in that order. But basically, in terms of sport, that's actually there, sporting rights, whether they be cricket, whether they be Formula One, rugby, tennis, football, and so on. Sadly, pornography, again, big driving force in terms of the market and the lines that come through from that perspective. And, of course, science fiction, for geeks who go and maintain, yes, we want wall-to-wall horror, wall-to-wall SF. We want to ensure that every single day I can watch an episode of Star Trek Voyager if I want, etc., etc. And then, great. Obviously driven via the whole notion of satellite television. And you know, Murdoch took a gamble, and it did pay off in terms of shelling out huge amounts of money, or at the time, millions for the exclusive rights to Premiership football, developed that. And, of course, you know, we see the sort of range of things that have developed within that as well. So it's not so much 57 channels as probably 500 channels that you actually got. And again, if you look through your average listings magazine or online sort of system that's actually got there, you have six pages which are all very tightly packed in terms of column, which deal with your main channels, your Channel 5, ITV2, ITV3, Drama, More 4, Paramount Network, 5 USA, 5 Star, 5 Select, CBS Justice, CBS Drama, Horror Channel, Yesterday, Reality, HGTV, Quest, Challenge, and so on and so on. Sky One, Sky Atlantic, Sky, blah, 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 etc., etc. Yeah, lots and lots of choice. There's no way physically any one human being can actually sort of watch everything that's on any particular 168-hour period. That's a week, basically, in terms of where you're coming through from that. So on the one hand, we're kind of in a golden age of television. You know, people will also say, with respect to the new players, the streaming players like Disney Plus, BritBox, Amazon Prime, Netflix, and so on, you can watch whatever you want to watch when you want to watch it. Flip side of it goes from the notion of, well, do you then have that shared water cooler moment? Can you, you know, is it more a case of the things that you actually watch, you select and personalise for yourself, etc.? Does it also have an ideological shift? You know, do you watch your news through Al Jazeera? Do you watch it through CNN? Do you watch it through Fox News? Do you watch it through Russia Today? You know, where you kind of pitch your sort of thing and what sort of messages are put out in terms of coronavirus. It's all a fake. It's all right. Michael Pence is praying for us. That's all good. But then again, you know, who knows? At least we're still here. Well, most of us are. Anyway. Yeah. Yasmin. She looked a bit peaky. All right. Okay. So, public service broadcasting. Many countries mourn the lack of success of public service broadcasting because they maintain that every country needs a BBC. They need a broadcaster that can, at its heart, produce unbiased and appropriate and quality-based programming which don't pander to the lowest common denominator, that actually do have something to say about life in the 21st century and so on. But if very few people are watching it, and if you're in a completely commercial world, then it'll be axed. So, you know, it's the old classic, if you don't use it, you lose it. What usually occurs in the States is regular fundraising drives to keep public service broadcasting going. Presumably you've seen that where they sort of say, send your money now, otherwise we'll go off, etc., etc. Now, you could say, well, why can't we have that here? Well, maybe we do, but it's just it's a licence fee, so it's a kind of a fee that people actually pay to work through that. Again, why are we asking? Well, there's the big question. You know, why is it important? How much do you watch? And that comes around to the exercise I'll give you in a few moments. Partly, it goes back to, again, that public sphere. You know, everybody around this table will be watching different kinds of programming. Sometimes your programming will be similar and it'll coalesce, etc. And sometimes there'll be series which will get good word of mouth and you'll sort of find a combination factor in that. But it's a changing environment. You know, sometimes people say, I've got other things to do other than to watch sort of school series. Who binge watches here? Everybody, yeah. So, you know, it's... do you find when you binge watch, is it three episodes, four episodes, five? What's the biggest number of episodes you've actually binge watched?
Probably like two seasons.
Two seasons.
I lost all of the thicker in 2 days.
Good choice, though. Yeah, Peter Capaldi, good choice. Yeah. Talk about the thick of it, actually, with the level 2 module communications in the public sphere. So, good research for that, Alan. Mm-hmm. Also, again, does it deal with national identity? Because clearly when it comes to, in Britain, state occasions, royal openings of parliament, the whole things that we're supposed to do very well as a country, and sporting events like the Grand National, Royal Ascot, Wimbledon, FA Cup final and so on, it's very much kind of relevance to how that national identity is being portrayed. Probably even more important in these periods of transition days, you know, whilst we're not in Europe, not out of Europe, before we actually head to the full sort of system next year, or die of, you know, some sort of virus. Must be more positive. Bottom line, the old model of television, and radio for that matter, has changed with the digital revolution. And as we move into digital world, that whole shift of that, whereby television used to be consistently delivered via the ether, and that's one of the reasons why, because the television signals were transmitted out into space, you know, aliens from Alpha Centauri might only now be receiving some of the sort of early sort of speeches that were developed in the sort of the 1950s, 1960s, etc. As it sort of goes on there, we've moved very much into the sort of digital world and selecting things from that point of view. Also, whereas competition is often seen as good, if there's so much competition and there's so much choice, in the words of the ancient Buddhist saying, where there is choice, there is misery. You know, there is so much that's actually on. How do you actually get the time to watch every episode of Stranger Things, The Thick of It, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, etc., etc., any of the sort of lines that are actually within that? But of course, there's always the free market approach that, you know, ultimately people would say, well, it's the customer is king or queen. They will decide, you know, what things they want to watch, etc. And if they decide that what they want to watch, you know, on a regular basis happens to be, random choice here, Film 4 or Sky Hits or Sky Greats or BT Sport 3 or Sky Arena or the whole notion of Agatha Christie's Poirot or more 10 years younger in 10 days and more Me and My Beautiful Face. It's entirely up to yourself, etc. You know, noughts and crosses and so on. And it's interesting that the habits of television, Amazon Prime with respect to Picard, kind of avoided what Netflix has done, what Amazon Prime used to do, which is basically they drop the whole series at once. You know, kind of started going back to the traditional model of releasing it one episode per week rather than one. I mean, that doesn't mean that people will still not binge watch it or wait for it and then watch it all in one sort of thing, etc. But it's interesting in terms of viewing habits and how that's sort of manifest. But of course it does give you tremendous opportunity for developing, you know, ideas and aspects as well. So, some of the principles of the BBC that I'd argue actually, despite the flack and the problems that they tend to take, have been there since Reith was in charge and probably still remain in place today. Universality. It's seen as a service which, as the motto on Broadcasting House actually says, nations shall speak peace unto nation. There is a sense that actually it represents at its best the best of what is British. Fairness, equity. Clearly, you don't have to necessarily be a social justice warrior or a woke expert to actually appreciate that sometimes people feel it's going too far down that particular line of representation and so on. But at the same time, you know, we live in an environment which is changing, which is adjusting, which is working through that. And also accountability. And that's the most pernicious one, potentially, because, you know, when you have to justify every penny of your expenses and the recent saga about why are the women only paid half as much as the men and why are the BBC people paid so much and why is Gary Lineker paid £1 million a year and why is Graham Norton paid this and so on and so forth. Whilst initially kind of being a useful headline, the flip side of that is, well, it does tend to start, you know, raising that question of, well, yeah, basically, you know, I'd have to work quite a long time to actually pick up what Lineker gets, you know, over a couple of shows, etc. It's a difficult call. you know, I'm not sure where sort of things go when you start talking about accountability, whether you go into financial envy issues and so on, is open to that. In terms of values, well, these are the kind of things that it would say are at the heart of what is the BBC. It's democratic. It's meant to obviously ensure that all viewpoints are aired equally, that there is a kind of balance of those viewpoints, etc. It's seen as very much part of the driving force of being creative and cultural. BBC Sounds, BBC Introducing. The argument here is that the BBC should be producing popular programmes in certain instances, because otherwise, you know, why would you have a BBC if you can't actually have that moment where you can actually sort of see who is the current sort of Bake Off champion or whatever, although obviously that's an example where the BBC lost Bake Off and it went to Channel 4. Any Bake Off fans here? Is that a yes?
Yeah.
Wow, Nina.
That
Did you feel it lost something when it went to
to
Channel 4? What did it lose?
Had the familiarity. Mary Berry, can't lose her. Stupid prick. No one knows that's in literature.
Yeah, but Mary Berry. And what about Paul Hollywood? You think? You know,
I don't like him.
No.
Funny in Mary Berry's eye.
Yeah.
Like.
Again, classic example of how you start beginning to identify with the presenters and almost kind of feel personally affronted when somehow, you know, switched and worked on that sort of basis. Educational, well, yes, you can actually sort of, again, look at the ways in which you can appreciate the planet in terms of Blue Planet. You can appreciate other sort of aspects which maybe you wouldn't encounter. BBC Bite Size, obviously feeding into the educational side of things, etc. And again, it gives you that shared sense of community, shared sense of values, ways in which there's a kind of commonality of what sort of programmes we happen to like, etc. And of course, particularly important these days, it looks to be a global brand. A global brand that effectively will sort of connect externally with all sorts of things. It's interesting that we've almost come full circle with the BBC and ITV and Channel 4, all now fully backing something which was suggested about 10 years ago. And people said, no, no, there's no future in that whatsoever. We can't do that. Which, of course, is BritBox, where effectively it's a streaming service exactly analogous to, it's defined very much as being the British Netflix because of the success that Netflix and Amazon Prime have actually had. Now, I say success probably in inverted commas, because Netflix changed their recent audience metrics recently, which used to always maintain that in order to be classified as a viewer, you had to watch the whole show on Netflix. Now you just have to tune in for a couple of seconds and it'll count you basically as a viewer, which is almost back to those days which were used quite frequently in both the BBC and ITV, whereby the BBC had this thing called audience reach, where audience reach was the programme might have been on somewhere in the background as you were passing through, either living room or just on in the background, you'd be classified as an audience with that. And most of the audience figures were collated on the basis of a sample size of 5,000. 5,000 people who would collate their own diaries and actually make a note of what they watched. And that's how you kind of generated audience figures, etc. With the digital environment, it's slightly more interesting how things are connected from there. Any questions? Well, let's talk about this particular line that was put forward by Foster in 2001. The best brains in Britain have struggled for years to find a definition of public service broadcasting. They've all failed because there's no such thing. And maybe that last sentence is where I would probably like to wrap up this whole notion of framing television. Public service television is what, at any moment in time, the public want it to be.